Good afternoon. We're back with another episode of the Sean Mo Hoops podcast. I'm pleased to have with me Scott Phillips, national college basketball writer for NBC Sports. Scott, it's been a year since you last came on, but how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Sean. Thanks again for having me on. And yeah, it's been a little bit too long since I've joined the Sean Mo Hoops podcast. So happy to be here. Happy to talk Final Four. And yeah, we got plenty to discuss, I'm sure.
Well, going back to when we last chatted on the podcast, it was really about a year ago, the Wednesday or Thursday before the Final Four, and you succinctly walked through all three games and predicted the winner, but not just predicting the winner, kind of walking through exactly how each team was going to win. So definitely interested to get your thoughts on this year's Final Four, but I know it's a few days in the past, but would love to kind of get your thoughts on the Elite Eight games, given how close and exciting they were, and kind of maybe which team surprised you the most out of the Final Four teams that we have.
Yeah, that was an incredible Elite Eight, huh? I mean, between all four games, the close results, the star power with teams like Duke and Kentucky involved, and, you know, obviously a disappointing outcome for maybe some casual NBA fans who wanted to see some of the bigger one-and-done NBA draft type of names playing in the Final Four. But in terms of sheer drama and what you were looking for out of an actual basketball game in a vacuum, you couldn't ask for much better. I mean, you had pretty much every game coming down to the wire, maybe with the exception of Texas Tech with that silly technical foul on Josh Perkins, but you know, how could you ask for a better game than Virginia-Purdue with Carson Edwards and his high-level shot making and Ty Jerome and Kyle Guy returning the favor on the other end and Virginia kind of overcoming some of those demons from the loss to UMBC last year to get in the Final Four? And I guess the team that impressed me the most out of any would be Auburn, just because they've continued to be kind of the Cinderella story of this NCAA tournament, if you will, even though they are a number five seed. I was just impressed by the way that they came out and ran with North Carolina, put up 97 points on the Tar Heels. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think it was 12 second half three-pointers in that win over North Carolina. And then they play a Kentucky team that beats them twice during the regular season. They're without Chuma Okeke, who's been arguably their best player over the last month of the season. And Kentucky plays them off of the three-point line, and they still find a way to win with Bryce Brown and Jared Harper both having unbelievable games. So to me, I think Auburn's been really impressive throughout this whole NCAA tournament. I pegged them as a sleeper Final Four team heading into it, but I never imagined that they would get past the blue blood gauntlet of Kansas, North Carolina, and Kentucky to get there. So incredible job by Bruce Pearl and his staff, and that team is very dangerous heading into that Virginia game.
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of surprising, I wasn't too surprised they beat UNC, but the way they did it, I think that was the first time I had seen, you know, you see Kobe White rushing down the court to get a layup before the defense gets back and set up, and then you have Auburn going right back at him and scoring before UNC can get set up. And that was probably one of the first times in recent memory I can remember a team pushing it back at UNC. And then, you know, to go just a few days later to play Kentucky and really start out pretty slow, and then to kind of come back in the second half and win in overtime. So definitely interested to get your Auburn and UVA thoughts. But I know you briefly mentioned Texas Tech and Gonzaga, and you know, for me, I definitely thought Gonzaga was going to win that game. But as the second half started and time kept on ticking, you could see Texas Tech really controlling the game with their defense. What are your thoughts on Texas Tech, and how surprising was their win over Gonzaga?
I think Chris Beard's the national coach of the year. I mean, he's replaced five of his top seven guys, including a lottery pick in Zaire Smith, who he kind of developed out of nowhere. And, you know, for them to get graduate transfers, guys like Matt Mooney and Tariq Owens, and to develop Jarrett Culver into a star of his own, it's really a testament to that program and that culture right now. Texas Tech has done a tremendous job of in-house development. Clearly what they're doing to get people to mesh together quickly is also working, particularly on the defensive end. I mean, it's hard enough to play offense when you have, you know, five or six new rotation guys, but to get all those guys to buy in defensively and make them the number one defense in the country is pretty much an incredible feat if you think about it, particularly, again, with transfers like Mooney coming from a smaller level and Tariq Owens at a place like St. John's that didn't necessarily stress the defensive end nearly as much as Texas Tech does. So I think they're really dangerous. I pegged them to make the Final Four out of this West region. I didn't know if they'd necessarily beat Gonzaga, though. I thought Gonzaga might have issues with Florida State and that Texas Tech was better suited to take down the Seminoles. But, you know, Texas Tech's defense proved me wrong. They've got a go-to shot maker in Jarrett Culver. And you have to really love the way that Matt Mooney and David Moretti have started to play off of Culver as the second, third options in the scoring column. Both those guys are playing with a lot of confidence hitting shots right now. And I think Mooney in particular has grown more comfortable as a secondary ball handler who can alleviate some stress as well.
Yeah, well, just staying on that, and one thing on Gonzaga, just because we won't get to talk about them really for the rest of the year, and not sure if you know this, but being from Chicago, getting to watch a lot of Zach Norvell, I always wonder how he ended up at Gonzaga. And I was curious if you knew any of the backstory and his recruitment or how he ended up choosing Gonzaga.
Well, Gonzaga does a great job of recruiting nationally, and I think that's been understated a little bit at times. I know that they've brought in a lot of transfers and a lot of West Coast guys, but they also scan the country. And with that class in particular, they had some early scholarships that they had allocated to look for. So assistant coach Brian Michelson really deserves a lot of credit for this one. He scouted Norvell in a lot, particularly, you know, heading into that final summer before senior season, really made a push to get Zach Norvell on campus with Gonzaga. And there's a little bit of a connection there. Jeremy Pargo is a Chicago guy who went on to play Gonzaga. He knew Zach Norvell a little bit and was able to kind of bridge a little bit of the gap there. And I think people need to realize that a lot of Chicago-based student athletes are looking to get away from the city to play college basketball. The in-state programs in Illinois haven't been particularly strong lately. You look at DePaul and Northwestern and Illinois, and all of them have been very sluggish over the last 10 years or so. And with, you know, a lot of the neighborhoods in Chicago being unsavory at this point with the violence and the school systems and things like that, kids are looking to escape and get out of there as soon as they can. And, you know, to have a place like Gonzaga that's a noted four-year program that develops players, Norvell had a red shirt because of an injury, but you saw how it benefited him the last 2 years. I think it's been a great fit for him, and he's going to be a fascinating player to watch if he returns for next season.
Definitely. And one more thought on the Final Four. We have Michigan State, Duke. Michigan State taking down Zion and RJ Barrett. And Duke was living on borrowed time after the UCF game and then even the Virginia Tech game. But I still didn't see them losing to Michigan State, just how they'd had much success against Tom Izzo and the Spartans as well as Big Ten teams. But it finally caught up with them, you know, the lack of, I guess, depth and outside shooting. But what were your thoughts on the Duke-Michigan State game and watching that on Sunday?
It was fascinating to me because I don't think they did nearly a good enough job, Duke, at slowing down Cassius Winston and forcing pressure on the Spartans' offense. To only force 7 turnovers, particularly when Winston has seemed gassed at times during this NCAA tournament, how do you force a guy who's playing 40 minutes into only one turnover, particularly with a great on-the-ball defender like Trey Jones? I'm interested that Duke really didn't try to push the tempo a little bit more in that one, maybe throw some different looks at Winston and try to wear him down over the course of the game. And I think you have to give a lot of credit to Xavier Tillman as well. He's been really the unsung part of the Spartans team since stepping up with that Nick Ward injury. And I think he's really outplayed Ward since Ward's return. And, you know, he's the type of lift on the interior with Ward and Tillman alternating that is very tough to compete with. Both those guys are bangers. Tillman has a little bit more skill than given credit for. He can step out and knock down a three. He can throw some passes. And again, the emergence of some of these freshmen like Aaron Henry and Gabe Brown in the Sweet 16, Kenny Goins hitting that key shot for the Spartans. I mean, this is just a very unsung, balanced Michigan State team. And they ran past a Duke team that was going to hero ball at the end of the game. And, you know, we're going to talk a lot in the future about how Coach K went with RJ Barrett in this situation. Or, you know, maybe he didn't go with RJ Barrett per se, but he allowed RJ Barrett to try to take over this game. And that just didn't happen, particularly when Zion Williamson was so dominant in the mid post and getting seemingly whatever shot he wanted at that time in the game.
Yeah, so now we go into Saturday, and we have Virginia as a 5-point favorite over Auburn. And then the second game, we have Michigan State as a 2.5-point favorite over Texas Tech. So I'm curious if, you know, what your predictions are. Are we going to see kind of an all Under Armour final, an all Nike final, or an all defense final? What are you kind of thinking will happen come Saturday night in Minneapolis?
My prediction so far is Virginia, Michigan State will meet in the finals. I think that this Virginia team is equipped to match up with Auburn, particularly on the perimeter. They just got through a hot shooting performance from Carson Edwards in the Elite Eight. And if you get through a 42-point performance where Carson Edwards is making 10 three-pointers, he's banking stuff in, and you're able to match that effort and still win, I think it's a very good sign. And, you know, Auburn might have been able to get past Kentucky. They were familiar with that team. They got a lot of looks from the elbows with Bryce Brown and a lot of looks at the rim with Jared Harper. But those looks are not nearly as easy to come by when you're facing a team like Virginia. So Auburn still has a chance to stay in it. Obviously, the Tigers shoot the three ball very well. They're streaky from that, particularly in the second half of this NCAA tournament. And they also turn you over better than any team in this field. But, you know, Virginia's guards are veterans. Ty Jerome and Kyle Guy have both been in these spots before. They're both going to match what Brown and Harper bring to the table. And I think they play those guys off the line enough to make the Auburn offense have a difficult night.
How important has Clark been to UVA? For me, I thought he was going to be extremely important, especially in the Sweet 16 and Elite Eight, where UVA was facing very talented point guards and Peyton Pritchard. And then you come over to Purdue. And even though Carson Edwards went absolutely nuts, I still thought having his quickness and kind of ability to be a pest was really important. And I could see that playing a factor in UVA. But how important has he been, as well as some of the other, you know, maybe unsung heroes for UVA outside of the big three?
I think he's been huge because he alleviates a lot of ball handling pressure off of Ty Jerome and Kyle Guy. Those guys can then be set to run off of screens. Virginia likes to run two or three guys at a time in different continuous motion to try to get them shots. And when you have Clark running and facilitating the offense, it gets two really, really good shooters involved in Jerome and Guy, who are coming off the first catch. And if those guys don't have an option, they can either throw to each other, maybe throw to DeAndre Hunter for a secondary pass, or just reinitiate the offense with Clark. But you kind of hit it on the head, Sean, that quickness, that ability to, you know, kind of help facilitate and ease things for, you know, Jerome and Guy has really kind of taken Virginia to another level. I think before they were trying to get Braxton Key more involved, maybe put him in the middle of some zones. But in this tournament, they've seemed to rely heavily on Clark and played him heavy minutes in terms of what he's been able to accomplish. And credit Tony Bennett and his staff. This wasn't some top 100 guy that everyone was pining for. They kind of took, you know, a flyer on Kia Clark, and really he's paid off for them so far in this freshman season.
Yeah, regarding Auburn, they really rely on forcing turnovers. And going back to the UNC game, they did that numerous times in the first half. You know, Kobe White, as much as I love him, was fairly careless with his ball handling ability. And they really turned the Tar Heels over into easy baskets. And that's something UVA doesn't do. And then you add in how reliant they are on the three-point shooting and the dome effect. I think I'm going to definitely agree with you on UVA. And I think them, you know, really going through that Purdue game where they should have lost but hit the miraculous shot and kind of overcame a heroic performance from Carson Edwards, probably kind of was that one game that you look back on each, you know, for most of the tournament teams besides Villanova last year and UNC in 2009, but kind of the game that maybe got them over the hump. But you have them matching up with Michigan State. Do you think the Michigan State-Texas Tech game will be close, or do you think Michigan State will kind of control that throughout in kind of a low-scoring affair?
I think it'll definitely be a low-scoring affair, that's for sure. I think it's like, isn't it around like 130 right now for the over-under?
So yeah, we have 131 in the UVA game and then 132.5 for the Michigan State game. So definitely no track meet set up for the Minneapolis.
Yeah, I'd definitely go the under on the Michigan State-Texas Tech game in particular. With Virginia and Auburn, they can at least knock down shots and start getting hot. And we saw that in the tournament in the Elite Eight and the Sweet 16 for both of those teams. But, you know, with Michigan State-Texas Tech, I think this one's going to be a straight-up rock fight. You have two great defenses. You have two tempos that I think are in the 250s. And again, I just think that the nerves, the ability of playing on that big stage, the fact that Texas Tech hasn't been there before, the pressure kind of being on Michigan State, weirdly, for being, quote, the familiar program, if you will, even though those guys haven't really played there before. That's a fascinating game, and I think it comes down, again, to Cassius Winston. He's been arguably the best player in this NCAA tournament so far. He's way better at lead guard than anybody Texas Tech can bring to the equation, and you know the Red Raiders are going to make life difficult on him. They obviously have a great defense, the number one in the country, but you know, you look at the point guards that Texas Tech has had to face during this NCAA tournament, and it's been rather underwhelming. Josh Perkins was kind of the you know, guy that they had to face for Gonzaga, and he's never really been applauded as one of the best point guards in college hoops. Xavier Simpson for Michigan has a lot of offensive flaws, and you can play off of him and let him shoot to try to beat you. And I just don't necessarily know that Texas Tech is equipped to face a guy like Cassius Winston, who is putting pressure on you for 40 minutes a game, who has a lot of options and knows how to find them. And again, I think that interior of Tillman and Ward is an underrated facet as well, that guys like Odiasi are going to have to defend straight up in order to be able to keep Texas Tech in this game.
So for Texas Tech, you mentioned the Lee guard and Matt Mooney, who I know you're familiar with from the Chicago days, has been kind of filling that role. And he came from Air Force in South Dakota as a grad transfer and a second team all conference. Did you kind of see him being able to play at this high of a level? I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts have been on him this season.
I pegged him as a mid-major guy coming out of high school, but I never thought that he would make this much of an impact on a Final Four team coming from the Big 12 champions. And it's a testament to his development and his growth, and obviously what the staffs at his previous stops have done as well. But, you know, he's the perfect type of program player who is willing to just fit in and do what it takes to win. The numbers aren't particularly gaudy, but he plays his role. He knocks down shots. He's a secondary handler and facilitator. He's one of the better defenders in this tournament that's left, a great two-way guard. And, you know, the fact that they don't need him to take over a game and they can just put the ball in Jarrett Culver's hands is really a huge benefit to Mooney, because he's not the type of guy who can create his own shots. He's not going to just go out and get you a hero bucket if you need it, but being that safety valve and that second option who can hit down, catch, and shoot threes, that's a great role for him. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see if he's able to kind of get loose in this game, because obviously Texas Tech is going to key in on Jarrett Culver. They're going to want to get him as many touches as possible, but he started to get a little bit cold from three-point range as the season has worn on. So Michigan State's going to throw a lot of different junk defenses and looks at him, a bunch of different guys in the wing, and I'm interested to see if guys like Moretti and Mooney continue to hit shots at a high clip.
Okay. Well, so you have UVA and Michigan State, and I have it in my mind who I think will win that game, but curious your take. I know in the past we've had Michigan State really give UVA problems in the tournament, one time as a number one seed and then upsetting them in the round of 32 a few years ago. Does Michigan State and Tom Izzo have enough to match up with UVA, or would this be kind of the perfect ending for UVA and Tony Bennett winning his first championship by beating Tom Izzo, who's given him so much problems in the past?
Well, I'd say Michigan State definitely has more than enough to stay in this game, if not win it. You know, when you beat Duke, and they're arguably the most talented team in the country, certainly not the most cohesive and with many flaws themselves, but you have a chance to kind of compete with anybody, especially from a confidence perspective. And, you know, Michigan State's not going to be fazed at all if they face a team like Virginia, who's a number one seed and an ACC champion. But, you know, I just love the makeup of this Virginia team. And you have so many different ball handlers, you have different shooters, you have ways to go inside. And Mamadi Diakite, a guy we haven't really even talked about yet, is playing some of his best ball of the season on the interior for Virginia at this point. And, you know, I like the way that Tony Bennett has kind of shortened the rotation as well. We talked about a lot more depth for this team coming into the NCAA tournament with guys like Braxton Key or Jay Huff. And really, he's just kind of gone to his main five or six guys that he's relied on the most. And that small guard lineup with Clark in the mix with Jerome and Guy, I think, is kind of elevated those two guys off the ball into shooting performances and gotten them off of cold stretches that they might have had early in the tournament. And, you know, again, I think nerves comes into play for Virginia. They have a lot of pressure to make this situation and to be in a national title picture. But having already beaten Gardner-Webb and having that shaky early first round and first weekend, I think really benefited them. And that comeback win over Purdue showed me a lot, and that they're kind of ready to exercise their demons and make a run here. I think they're the best overall team, the best defense, and they've got the most weapons who can go off in a game in this Final Four, in my opinion.
Speaking of Diakite, I think, you know, not only did he hit the shot, but from a defensive end, really brings something in terms of shot blocking presence that probably wasn't utilized as much early on when he was probably averaging around 20 minutes. And now you see him playing 27, 28, 35, and then 42 in the overtime game. So really being a factor on the boards as well as on defense in the paint to go along with his scoring output. I'm sure, you know, UVA doesn't want him jacking threes or shooting jump shots, which you usually see maybe one to three times a game. But, you know, if he's going to give you 14 points, 17 points, I think they'll definitely take that. Stepping aside from this game, I'm curious your thoughts, because this kind of was bothering me on the Purdue side that I don't think got as much attention. But if you go back to the Duke UCF game, Duke won on basically a missed free throw and the lack of boxing out on UCF's part. And then Purdue, you have Harms, and then you have Grady Eifert trying to box out Diakite. I know it's kind of a Wednesday morning quarterback on this one, but do you think Purdue should have had, you know, their big guys in there to box out? Or, you know, for me, having Grady Eifert to box out Diakite, probably, I know not the most explosive leaper, that's Zion, but I'd say the quickest leaper in the NCAA was a big kind of faux pas on Matt Painter's part.
Yeah, definitely. That's something that has definitely not been talked about enough in terms of Purdue missing that box out and missing that ability to close that game out, because, you know, everyone talked about the fouling up three scenario and how that backfired. And that's silly because Purdue had the game won. I mean, all they had to do is secure that rebound. You know, they get fouled and, you know, Virginia has maybe 1 second, 1.5 seconds at most if Purdue goes to the other end and makes two free throws and makes it a 3-point game again. And again, there's going to be a lot of questions asked about what happened at the end of that game. But, you know, another thing too is, how do you not get someone else involved besides Carson Edwards? But, you know, to me, missing that rebound definitely hurts. That's going to, you know, affect Matt Painter and his staff for a long time. And you have to credit Virginia, particularly Clark, for getting that ball in the backcourt, rifling that one-handed pass to Diakite with 2 seconds left, and just having the presence of mind of knowing time, score, and situation to find that guy for the tying shot and taking it to overtime.
Yeah, that was an amazing play, especially with Guy and Jerome on both sides of the court, probably screaming for the ball to kind of get up a last-second three, and just fires such a perfect pass. And then also for Diakite, just to, you know, perfectly catch it and shoot it in rhythm, well before time expired, was, you know, something remarkable, and probably what we'll definitely be showing in one shiny moment a few days from now when UVA is cutting down the nets over Michigan State. You know, if we do happen to see a UVA versus Texas Tech game, do you think it would be first to 50? To win in that one, or what would you kind of expect?
Yeah,
I don't think it's out of the realm of possibilities with how good the defenses are and the slow tempo. But what would you think if that game were to happen?
Well, again, I like that Virginia has the more options, and the fact that we're not even mentioning DeAndre Hunter, who's a potential top 10 pick. That just shows how deep and balanced this team is. I mean, they've had guys like Diakite and Clark step up. We know how good Jerome and Guy are in terms of hitting shots. And DeAndre Hunter is such a presence on the defensive end. And I think he's the key reason why they get past Auburn, because you had that Chuma Okeke Purifoy matchup on a guy like Luke May. And North Carolina just couldn't defend that four spot, particularly when they were spacing the floor. That's basically eliminated with DeAndre Hunter on the floor for Virginia. He's going to take away anything Purifoy's trying to get. He can guard him inside or outside. He can switch. He can do a number of different things defensively that a lot of these teams in the field aren't capable of, because they don't have an athlete who's as talented, as skilled as Hunter is. But again, it might be in the 50s. It might be a low scoring game. But when you have a guy like Hunter who could defend Culver one-on-one and not have a lot of help, and have his ability to defend kind of step up and showcase there, I think that's very favorable to Virginia. As long as guys like Moretti and Mooney are contained, I think Owens and Diakite are pretty much a wash on the interior. And again, I just like Virginia as a whole in terms of the guys that can take over a game with their perimeter shooting and their balance that they have on both ends of the floor with Diakite and Hunter.
All right, well, so I think we're both in agreement on UVA advancing and then winning the championship, Tony Bennett's first one. And I know you're a Final Four regular, so how are you kind of, are you excited, or what are your thoughts on going to Minneapolis? I know that's an easy travel trip for you, but between Minneapolis and these teams, you know, how do you think this one will rank on the Final Four scale?
I don't have high expectations, but I think that's in part because, you know, Minneapolis is not necessarily an appealing place to visit this time of year. It's a beautiful city. I love it in the summer. It's got a lot of tremendous amenities from the downtown area and from a sports perspective. And I'm really looking forward to seeing US Bank Stadium, just because I've heard a lot of good things about it. And they've built it for acoustics with Vikings fans in mind. So I'm anxious to hear how loud it gets at certain times. But, you know, in terms of like a casual, you know, aesthetically pleasing basketball perspective, this is not the Final Four to bring your casual basketball fans to watch. I mean, these are four of the slowest teams in the country, a lot of defensive-minded groups. I think, again, with the dome setting and some of the nerves at play with three first-time Final Four teams, that we're going to start to see some games that might hedge towards the high 40s and, you know, low 50s. And yeah, I think it's going to be fun. I think that as long as the games are close, that really doesn't matter. But we're going to get a lot of those complaints from Joe NBA fan who's tuning in and watching his sixth college basketball game of the season. And that can get a little bit annoying to deal with at times. But I still think, again, given how good the Elite Eight was, arguably the best we've ever had, that you have to have some high expectations for at least decent games heading into this weekend. I just don't know if they're going to be that aesthetically pleasing to watch.
So you're saying the unders are probably a good bet in potentially all three games?
For definitely Michigan State, Texas Tech. Again, I think Virginia and Auburn hit enough threes where they could get into a shot-making contest and that game could kind of flip a switch. And we saw that a little bit in the second half of Virginia-Purdue. We certainly saw that in the second half of Auburn-North Carolina, where Auburn just started bombarding them with threes. But, you know, again, I think that that under could easily hit because we see the nerves. We see the three-point shooting tends to dip a little bit in the Final Four with the dome background. And, yeah, the unders could easily be in play for all three games this weekend.
All right, last question for you, and this is on a non-Final Four topic, but UCLA, they've been searching for a coach for a while.
A long time.
And I was reading, I think this morning, about Jamie Dixon being the favorite. I was just curious your thoughts on the job and, you know, will whoever they bring in, will they have a chance to be successful or at least as successful as some of the fans expect them to be?
I mean, if you're settling for Jamie Dixon, who is a tremendous coach, by the way, that's no knock on Jamie Dixon at all, but that guy was chased out of Pittsburgh. And UCLA's fan base is fickle, and they expect to be in the national title contention, and they get a little agitated if you only make Sweet 16s, as we saw with Ben Howland on the tail end of his career. And again, if Jamie Dixon is underwhelming in Pittsburgh, then what's the perception going to be like with a UCLA fan base that wants national titles? I mean, Jamie Dixon's not really getting the sexiest recruits. He's not generally in the picture for a lot of McDonald's All-Americans. And, you know, if I'm UCLA, I'm waiting on Chris Beard and doing everything I can to get him to try to come. And I don't know how feasible that is, given some of the other offers in play, potentially Arkansas, who's been in the mix, and, you know, some of these other schools that have opened up as well. Or maybe Beard just wants to stay at his alma mater, where he's comfortable and has won the last 2 years. But, you know, if you're UCLA and you're settling for Jamie Dixon, that's really a gigantic miscalculation in terms of where you were at heading into this coaching search, particularly starting on January 1st. And again, that's not a knock on Jamie Dixon, who's done a great job of turning around TCU and making them a viable NCAA tournament caliber program. But, you know, if you're UCLA and you have, you know, pictures of getting back to the Final Four and winning over this fickle fan base, Jamie Dixon's not the guy to do it.
Yeah, being at some of the games and reading the LA Times, I know they had their sights set on Tony Bennett, but him making the Final Four run, I thought it was a long shot to begin with, but I think him making the Final Four run definitely kind of ends the majority of that discussion. So it will be interesting to see where they go, but just wanted to thank you for coming on and providing a lot of keen insights, and always enjoy discussing basketball with you, and now hopefully grabbing a Juicy Lucy in Minneapolis at some point in time this weekend.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me on, Sean. And just a warning to everyone listening, I was good on my picks last year. I am not guaranteeing success this year. So take caution. Good luck in your endeavors if you do end up wagering something on this game. And hopefully it's a fun Final Four weekend with a lot of similar results that we saw in the Elite Eight.
All right. Well, that wraps up another episode and the last episode of the college basketball season. So we'll be back after the Final Four to recap that. But want to thank everybody for listening and enjoy the games on Saturday and Monday.